Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Martin Weller in this episode. Martin is Professor of Educational Technology with the Open University UK, which he joined as a lecturer in 1995. Martin chaired the Open University's first major e-learning course in 1999 and was the university's first VLE director. Martin's research activity is based on open education and digital scholarship. We talked in the Jenny Lee Building at the Open University's Milton Keynes campus.
Right, I'm joined by Professor Martin Weller, who's Professor of Education Technologies with the Open University. Martin, great to be chatting with you today.
Great, yeah, good to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Brilliant, thanks, Martin. Can we start with just a brief overview of your career and publications to date?
I joined the Open University back in 1995, so old-timer now. And when I joined, e-learning was still a new thing. I remember saying at my interview, have you thought about using the web for teaching? And everyone, that's interesting. So I launched the OU's first kind of big, I was part of a team that launched the OU's first big e-learning course in 99. And at the time, people said to me, no one's going to want to learn online. And we got something like 15,000 students on that course. So this was a massive course before MOOCs.
Which course was it,
Mike? So that was T171. It was called You, Your Computer and the Net. So it was a kind of introduction to computers and the internet and stuff. Yeah. And it was clear lots of people kind of were waiting to learn that way. My background was in artificial intelligence, but I'd been kind of experimenting with online tutor groups, but that course particularly kind of led me into a much more kind of e-learning pathway. So I published a book on the back of that in 2000, I think, which was Delivering Learning on the Net. And from there, I became the OU's first VLE director, and I published another book after that, which was about VLEs. And since then, I've become more interested in kind of different applications of technology and particular implications for academics and higher education. So what then later became termed digital scholarship. And I wrote a book in 2011 called The Digital Scholar. And I also work quite a lot in open education. So I'm director of a research group here called the OER Hub. And we research the impact of different forms of open education, whether that's OER or MOOCs or open access kind of things. And related to that, I wrote a book called The Battle for Open. So I think probably where I sit now, obviously I've published lots of papers along the way as well, but those two books, The Battle for Open and Digital Scholarship, probably represent my main areas of interest, really.
Right, and at least one of them is freely available
online. Both of those two are freely available, yeah, under Creative Commons license, yeah. So I'm a big open access advocate, so I couldn't write a book. My Digital Scholar book was kind of like mainly a rant about how we need to make stuff open and available. I couldn't write that and then not publish it openly. So yeah, so that was published with Bloomsbury Academic, and the Battle for Open was published with Ubiquity Press, and both are open access.
Brilliant. Well, we'll certainly link to both of those. Which VLE was the Open University using back there?
So it wasn't using a VLE when I became the director. We used a system called First Class, which was kind of online conferencing CMC system. And then we had kind of lots of different bits, which I think was the case for lots of universities. You had this kind of cottage industry around, so different faculties would be using different ways of creating websites and those kind of things. Mm. And so partly my job was to kind of review what was happening and come up with a proposal. And our proposal at the end of that stakeholder consultation was to adopt Moodle. And then I stood down, so I didn't do all the hard work of actually implementing Moodle. I just made the recommendation and ran then. But that was quite a big statement, I think, because at the time, it was Blackboard and WebCT were the kind of main players. And I think the OU adopting an open source system really gave people confidence to adopt that as well. I mean, we weren't by any means the first people to do it, but I think being a big provider to do it was quite significant.
Great. Actually, I remember back in those days, the EBBS system was Open University one, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that was the first one. So I wasn't in IET, where I am now at the moment, Institute of Education Technology, but they used to use that system, and they ran some of the first sort of collaborative programs online. Because of course, for us as a distance university education, that when I first joined the OU, part of my contract was to spend 2 weeks every summer at summer schools. And summer schools were only the way we could get people together usually. Some people might go to face-to-face tutorials. But being able to get people to work online was kind of a real breakthrough for us. And suddenly we could do all this kind of collaborative work that we couldn't do before. It's a really exciting time, I think. We kind of suddenly thought we can change the way we teach. It was kind of lots of innovation happened around then.
Yeah, I'd imagine. Well, I think it's Nipper, isn't it, who writes about the third generation of education. So that whole online discourse possibility really did open up brand new ways of
Cambridge. Yeah, so people like Robin Mason were particularly influential here in IIT. And I think it's possible we kind of overdid it at the start. It's kind of like, and this week there's another collaborative activity. I think it's just, well, not another one. We kind of got overexcited by the possibility. But it really was a kind of a game changer for us, I think. You know, and we're still feeling the effects of that, I think. You know, we're still sort of like learning to cope with what it means to be a university that can do that. So, for instance, you know, we now use Adobe Connect, I think, don't we? Yeah. to do synchronous events. But even getting those organised is a different type of thing from asynchronous events. Mm. So in some ways, what that did was it made the OU more like traditional universities, and traditional universities a bit more like the OU, because they started doing distance education, so we kind of merged in the middle, I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That so not only did it enable the Open University to do more, but it also opened up potentially competition.
It did, yeah. So I mean, certainly the kind of monopoly we had in many ways on distance education and part-time education disappeared a lot with the rise of the internet, because suddenly lots of universities could do it at fairly cheap. Because before, the kind of the investment was quite substantial to develop, you know, printed units and, you know, printing presses, and the amount of time it takes to develop a course. But creating one online sort of reduced some of those barriers. So it's made it a more interesting field, I think, which is
most definitely. So what are you currently researching, Madam? What are your current research interests? You mentioned some of the books you've done already.
Yeah, so currently researching impacts of open education. So I run a project which is funded by the Hewlett Foundation called GoGN, which is a global network of OER researchers. And that's really good. So we did a previous project called the OER Impact Hub, OER Research Hub, and we were looking at the impacts of OER, and we came up with open educational resources. And we came up with sort of 11 hypotheses that people tend to believe about them. I think it's like a lot of ed tech, education innovations. People have very firm beliefs about them, but they often don't have evidence to back those up. So people would say things like, you know, obviously OER improved performance or reduced costs and those kind of things, but there actually wasn't much evidence. So we started to gather that evidence. So the project I'm now leading, GoGN, is to try and develop that kind of global research community, because I think, like in lots of new fields, there isn't a kind of a critical mass of researchers doing that kind of critical evaluation. And in some ways that was true of distance education when the OU started, and that's exactly why things like IIT were formed. And we also run a few other projects, so we're working on a European project called BizMOOC, which is looking at MOOCs for professional development in the business world. So we tend to look at anything that's kind of looking at particularly the impact of open education and MOOCs.
Great, and that project's ongoing?
Yes, we're coming to the end of 3 years funding for GoGN, and we're looking to get some more. But it's been a very successful project. We've got a lot of good alumni from that, so people like Catherine Cronin and Chrissy Narenzi have come through GoGN. And often when we speak to our students, so we don't supervise them, they kind of have their own local supervisors. We provide a kind of global network, and we bring them together once a year at a conference and run a two-day seminar with them to try and help them through their research. And often what you find is that they'll say they're the only person in the institution who's remotely interested in this stuff. You know, it's like, so GoGen has been a kind of real lifeline for those people. It's a bit of a kind of like a network thing that then they kind of find it really important and really valuable, and they go on to help other people. So you do kind of spread that out. So particularly looking to kind of expand that. We've had a few people from Africa and the Global South, but I think that those are the areas we would particularly want to expand into, I think, to kind of offer more support in that area.
So you mentioned that you're gathering evidence as part of the OER Hub. What is that evidence revealing about OERs and their use?
So it's mixed, and sometimes it's difficult to get evidence, you know, particularly trying to get hard evidence of performance and improvement. But so we found a number of findings, and we've released an evidence report, which you can find on our oerhub.net website. A number of findings. So one was, often when people talk about OER, they say reuse is very low. But when we asked educators, do you adapt material, there's a very high percentage who say they do adapt it. So I think, as a small kind of finding, what that illustrates is that partly it's language. People don't often talk in terms of reuse. But if you talk to educators about adaptation, you get a very different answer. But also, there's a scale of that adaptation, from taking something and just inserting it and creating something around it, to actually modifying the resource itself. And I think we often don't appreciate there's a kind of scale of what people might do with a particular resource. But sometimes it's even just seeing a resource and drawing inspiration from it and taking the idea and then doing something different with it. But even that's very useful, I think. So I think there's a kind of lot of hidden reuse, if you might like, about OER. Students tended to find OER very useful, and they like the kind of variety of voices you get, so it's not just coming from one person. We looked at a lot of open textbook work as well. And there, one of the main benefits was that students, particularly if they are cautious about buying the textbook, particularly in the US where it's very expensive, they tend to hesitate about buying it because they want to see if the educator is really going to make use of it. Sometimes they recommend a textbook, but actually they only use it in week 5 for one chapter and you spent like $100 on a textbook. But if they do make extensive use of it, then those students might well be like 2 or 3 weeks behind before they purchase it. So with open textbooks, the educator can assume that all students have got it, and in fact all students have got it kind of right from the start, and it allows them to kind of approach the teaching in a different way. Mm. And interestingly, we're just coming to the end of another project, which is a UK open textbooks project, where we try to take the approaches that they've developed in the US and apply to the UK sector. We wanted to see whether there was anything kind of specific about the US sector and also Canada as well, kind of North America. The open textbook approach wasn't so applicable in other settings. And we found that there was actually a lot more interest in open textbooks than I was anticipating, I think, in the UK. But cost isn't such a driving factor. We don't tend to specify textbooks as rigorously as they do in the US. And perhaps they're not so expensive. We tend to have more of a reading list. Now, here are sort of like 5 books that you might want to read.
Yeah.
But in some ways, what that does is lower the threshold for adoption, because you can say to librarians or whatever, one of your 5 may as well be this free open one that you can adopt. You know, it's like, and there was a lot of interest, I think, in taking books and adapting them to particular contexts. So, for instance, I live in Wales, and they can't get publishers interested in the Welsh curriculum because it's too small a market for them. So open textbooks offers a potential route for them to kind of do something different that they want to do.
So, Madam, with such a rich history of research, what are some of the key ideas that you've developed over the last 20 years or so that you think are still really pertinent today, the sort that you think our listeners might get the most out of?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I've just completed a blog series of 25 years of EdTech. Mm. And it's remarkable how much the same things keep coming up again and again. Audrey Walters talks about this concept of zombie ideas we have in EdTech that just won't die. So I was looking at things like, you know, the promise of intelligent tutoring systems and artificial intelligence back in the late 80s and early 90s when I was doing this series. And some things are exactly what we're saying now about AI. So a kind of more generic point is, I think, there's a kind of cyclical nature about a lot of these ideas. They tend to come back. And related to that, I think there's a tendency in education technology, I think, for a kind of year zero mentality. It's kind of like, and we saw this particularly with MOOCs. It's like suddenly people were saying like, oh, it's like education has discovered the internet. And like, for all those who've been working, we're like, what? We've been doing this for ages. You know, it's like, and I understand why that happens. Because I think education technology is quite an interesting field in a way that people come to it from different sectors. Mm. So it's not like chemistry, where if you go to a chemistry conference, everyone studied chemistry degree and chemistry PhD, whereas you go to an EdTech conference and people might have a philosophy degree or, you know, a humanities degree or computer science, which makes it a very rich field, but it means there isn't that kind of accepted body of knowledge, kind of,
right,
that aren't canonical works or whatever, you know. So often people aren't aware of work that's gone before. So I think there is that kind of need to try and help overcome some of that, I think, because often people miss out quite valuable research. Sort of putting my cynicism aside, I think with MOOCs, a lot of that, they ended up reinventing things that we kind of already knew about how you need to support students and, you know, what you need to do to work effectively at a distance with learners. And, you know, that could have been beneficial, I think, to kind of have that work at the start. So I think there is that kind of like cyclical nature and also kind of just reinventing the wheel a bit. Other issues that I think are still interesting are, so I write about digital scholarship quite a lot, and I think just this whole idea of developing online identity. So I've sort of noticed a shift in my own practice. So I've been a blogger since about 2006. So I blog at edtechie.net, and it's kind of, I get quite a big readership there. But I think when I first started, I was the kind of evangelist. I used to get wheeled into do presentations to be the kind of, hey, everyone start blogging, it's great kind of thing. And similarly with social media when it came along. But I think now, you know, it's difficult to deny a kind of a lot of the dark side of being online, you know, whether that's trolls, abuse, you know, actual fake news or, you know, privacy, you know, data capitalism, all those kind of things. So there is a kind of real tension there, because I think all the things I used to think are still true, actually, you know, I still do have a lot of my kind of very rich engagement online with people, and it's how you form a network of peers. And some of the stuff, you know, is still quite a democratising space. You know, you have PhD researchers who can still have a very powerful voice. You don't need that kind of formal hierarchy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have all these other things, all these kind of the dark side of it, if you like. So I think we're trying to negotiate what that means in terms of scholarship and being an academic, how you encourage people to develop that online identity while still having a kind of, particularly for students, while still having a kind of duty of care for them as well. And I'm not sure what the answer is that, but I think I certainly feel that's a kind of rich area that we need to develop and negotiate as we go along over the next few years.
Mm. Can I ask how you keep on top of it all? Because you must be quite richly socially connected. How do you keep on top of all the ideas and different posts and things coming your way?
In some ways, I think there's a certain point when you develop a network that it does the work for you. At the start, there's a kind of investment phase where you kind of have to do a lot of work to kind of show that you're a worthy member of that community, if you like. But I think after a while, there's a kind of return on that investment, if you like. And good stuff kind of just filters through at the top. You know, if something's worth reading, then I know that it will bubble up through my kind of like my Twitter network or something.
Yeah.
So it sort of brought to your attention. In some ways, it sort of does a lot of that work for you. So it's almost like there's a kind of an intelligent filter happening for you. So it's in some ways, that reduces the effort that I need to put into that, I think.
Martin, we're now coming up to the end of 2018. Yeah. It's been an interesting year at the OU.
It certainly has.
And things are obviously still progressing in terms of online learning and education. Yeah. What are some of your observations about online education right now? What are some of the key themes that occur to you?
There's a lot of technologies that are kind of always just about to break through. So I think learning analytics, I mentioned artificial intelligence, you know, intelligent tutoring systems, all these kind of things. That this time they actually might break through. But I think what we're struggling with at the moment is the kind of balance between what does that mean for us? And so I think we kind of need to almost have an ethical approach to these things. It's like, so, you know, a lot of the kind of edtech venture capitalism is driven by the idea of, you know, teaching millions of people with no humans having to be involved kind of thing. That's kind of where the money lies. Yeah. But actually, I think useful edtech nearly always relies and helps kind of complement the human educator. So I think learning analytics are a really good example. Learning analytics can be used to kind of generate kind of automatic suggestions, which might be useful, might not. But I always think education is a very kind of human enterprise. Mm. So learning analytics are probably more useful if they're helping you as a learner and the educator kind of have some kind of dialogue around the bits you might be missing or where you might be struggling or how other people are performing. So if it helps kind of add nuance to that conversation. And I think that's actually the kind of phase we're entering into now, kind of almost cybernetic relationship, I think. And I think trying to retain the kind of human essence of education through there is not a trivial exercise, but I think it's a very important one.
Yeah, okay, so that whole, I guess technology and people finding their place, finding the best complementary relationship.
Yeah, because it's kind of pervasive now. It's not the case of, you know, it's something being done over here. It's like when we all started blogging or using social media, it was kind of like a niche interest, but you know, you can't argue that anymore. It's pervasive and everyone's using it. So that kind of changes the nature of how we use this technology. I think it's Clay Shirky's, isn't it? It's only when a technology becomes kind of completely pervasive and almost unnoticed that it becomes interesting, because that kind of really impacts upon society. And it's the same in education, I think. So now we kind of really need to think, what is it about education that we really value and that's really important for both learners and educators and society? And how do we preserve that and enhance it through the use of technology? And I think those are quite crucial questions. And I think that involves a dialogue often, I think, between kind of technology people and humanities people and philosophers and social scientists, you know, which I don't think we've kind of had much before.
Yeah. Related to this, I recently came across AIVA, AIVA, which is a virtual artist.
Right.
Okay. It's been programmed with a whole lot of classical music. It can now generate its own.
Yeah.
So it's writing wonderful classical scores. Yeah. I'm listening to it on Spotify. Yeah. It probably won't be long because we already have robotic musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereby an entire robotic industry might be out there generating really impressive classical music with no humans involved whatsoever.
But all this stuff kind of has a kind of ethical code built into the algorithm. So I don't know if you saw, there's a story recently where, was it Amazon? No, somebody kind of trained an AI thing to recruit people, and it ended up recruiting more men than women, preferring men to women. It's like, but the point is, that's not the AI doing that. It's doing that based on the information that you fed it. So it's kind of bringing forward all the kind of inbuilt bias and prejudice. So, like, you know, this stuff isn't ethically neutral, you know, it's like. So we kind of need to understand that in a much kind of deeper sense, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand at the OU there is an AIED group.
Yeah, that's
it's AIED, but it does have quite a strong ethics.
Yeah, that's right, absolutely.
So it sort of links on then to the next question, which is, what research would you most like to see at the moment? If you could invest whatever amount you needed to answer one research question, what would you pursue?
Open education is where my heart is, I think. So I think really sort of continuing the work we started with the OER Research Hub, kind of trying to see the impact of open education, but perhaps broadening that out to not just OER, but to open educational practice. So kind of what are the benefits for learners, for institutions and educators and researchers in open practice? It's not just kind of formal open access publication or open data, but also just kind of operating in the open. the, for instance, you know, we've kind of seen that, I think particularly in the UK where students have to pay fees, we started to see students are trialling study a lot more through OER before they pay, you know, £9,000 a year to go and study.
Yeah.
And so I think there's all those kind of areas you might explore and say, okay, what is the impact of that? Do those students then go on to study? Are they happier? Do we keep them more? But also, does it change the nature of society by kind of helping put this information out there? You know, we've been through things like Brexit and the Trump election, and where people have decried the point of experts, and you know, higher education has kind of often been seen as the enemy against these kind of things. I think what's our role within society more broadly? I mean, you only need to look at kind of any article about higher education, and if you look at the comments in the newspaper, pretty soon someone will be talking about these people in their ivory towers. You know, this idea that universities are not part of society, and I think open education has a real role to kind of blur those boundaries. So researching how to do that effectively and what the impacts are, I think, would be my kind of pitch.
And would that build on the work of the likes of OpenLearn, the OER universities?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Those kind of people, I think, are kind of, sort of trying to tinker with what it means to do a degree or to do learning. You know, so we're trying to smooth that pathway into a degree. So it's not like you're not studying and then you're studying a three-year degree. It's like, you know, you might take a few MOOCs, open courses, bits of OER for credit, build those up, and then perhaps take a particular course, or the OERU does, you can do the first year free and then sign up for formal studies. I think just trying to research where those things might be important for people.
Well, Martin, you've had a very, very long career to date. Still many years to come, I'm sure. But no doubt there have been people who have influenced you quite significantly over the years. Who are two people that you'd suggest as leaders or legends of online learning that you think have still relevant things to contribute today?
Yeah, so when I joined the OU, Diana Lorillard was here. I think Diana's done a lot of the sort of really foundational thinking, and so she developed a conversational framework about how we might think about using technology and planning. And I think often we lack that kind of pedagogic conceptual framework, I think, to operate in. So I think someone like Dan is very important. Slight aside, I did a bit of research recently with Katie Jordan, Owen DeVries and Viv Rolf, where we were looking at the kind of history of open education, and we were saying how people don't tend to cite a lot of the early research, which is often based around kind of much more kind of pedagogically driven stuff. And Katie did this kind of citation analysis, and we found six separate areas that kind of broadly come under open education. And there's very little connection between them. They're kind of isolated islands. So I think that kind of, in some ways, demonstrates that kind of year zero mentality. So I think raising the importance of that kind of conceptual pedagogic theory work that people like Diana led on is important. So she'd be important, I think. Yeah. And then someone like Bonnie Stewart in Canada, or George Vletsianos, also in Canada, have done lots of work on social media and the academic and developing online identities. So I think that gets to that point I was talking about earlier, kind of about establishing your online identity and understanding some of the tensions around it. So I think either of those would be, I found very, very sort of important when I'm talking about that kind of work, and they've sort of done some of the leading research there.
Well, Matt, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Nice day here at the Open University.
Yeah.
Autumn leaves.
Not too bad, yeah. It's always nice in autumn, isn't it, Walton Hall?
Well, thank you for all the work you've been doing in open education, online education. Look forward to your next book coming through.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
You can learn more about Martin and link to some of his publications from our website. His Twitter handle is mweller. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.